calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
A Bill of Rights read Thomas Jefferson in a letter to James Madison in 1796. A Bill of Rights is what the people are entitled to against every government, and what no just government should refuse or rest on inference. And sure enough, a Bill of Rights is what we got, and or what we have, what we got at that time. And is it being trampled? We'll be talking about that as we go through the day. Are we killing ourselves because corporations are keeping us stupid about science? Is the middle class being transferred from the U.S. to China as we get through the day? Our quote for the day, of course, from Thomas Jefferson. Lynn Landis is going to be with us in the second hour of our program. She has a case going before the Supreme Court about voting machines. And we'll be getting to this whole issue of the middle class in China. But first, we have with us Marlo Lewis. Marlo Lewis is a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org, where he writes on global warming, energy policy, and other public policy issues. Marlo, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
Marlo, I understand that you are of the opinion, correct me if I'm wrong, that a windfall profits tax is no way to deal with the current situation where the oil companies now here, we just had ExxonMobil, and I guess actually they were eclipsed more recently by Shell and BP, but at the time they showed the largest profit of any corporation in the history of human civilization. I mean, seriously, go back to Sumeria. The largest,
right.
They showed a larger profit than the British East India Company ever did. And there are people who are saying we should have a windfall profits tax. And my understanding is that you think this is a bad idea.
Well, I do, and that's the first I've heard that this is the largest profit in the history of the universe. But it makes sense because, after all, the United States government, for example, has the biggest budget of any government in the history of the world. Including the Roman Empire. I mean, that's in part it's the nature of civilization. As civilization gets wealthier, any of these monetary magnitudes will grow. The tax take of the U.S. government is bigger than, you know, any country in the world. I think the windfall profits tax is a terrible idea. You know, the thing is that there is a lot of misunderstanding out there about oil and gasoline and prices. Some people, the windfall profits tax crowd, believe, or at least they imply, that the reason why these oil companies, or the reason why gasoline prices have been so high, is that the oil companies are making so much profit, and that the oil companies are gouging us. And if we only removed some of the profit, then the cost of gasoline would go down. But the causality here is exactly backwards. The reason why their profits are so high is that gasoline prices are so high. And a big part of the reason why gasoline prices are so high is that crude oil prices are high. And crude oil prices are set in the global marketplace. No oil company, or certainly not any U.S. oil company, is in a position to dictate or even manipulate that price of crude oil, which accounts for about 85% of the price of gasoline at any given time.
Well, let's take a couple pieces of that, Marlo Lewis. First of all, international oil prices are set by a cartel. They're not set by the open market. They're set by, you know, OPEC sits around and says, what are we going to charge this month? So you've got a cartel. Secondly, in the United States, we have the petroleum industry, which is not a competitive market. In very, very little way does it resemble anything like a competitive market. You've got 10 companies that control 80% of the total refining capacity in the United States. 5 companies control half the nation's capacity just by themselves. This largely since 1981 when Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act and we saw all these mergers and acquisitions. And coincidentally, in 81, right after Reagan stopped that and the oil companies started merging into these mega giants, that was the last year that we saw operable capacity, in refining capacity in the United States, actually increase. Since then, it's been in a decline, which does what? As your refining capacity declines, your profits go up. I mean, isn't this the same thing that Enron did to California with the burn, baby, burn, and, hey, can you shut down my boiler for us, please? Because we're going to screw the citizens of California. We're going to stick it to Granny and get Gray Davis out of there so that Arnold Schwarzenegger, who having private meetings with Ken Lay, can become governor?
No, it's not. First of all, I mean, you said many things, and I'll try to address them.
Well, let me just toss one other in, and I'll give you a chance to take them all, because you also started out by saying that the windfall profits tax crowd is saying that if we put a windfall profits tax on the oil companies, that that's going to reduce the price of gasoline. And I've not heard anybody say that. What I've heard people say is if we put on a windfall profits tax, I mean, keep in mind, ExxonMobil is their revenues in 2005 over $1 billion a day. I mean, that's larger than the entire economies of all but 16 of the 184 countries ranked by the World Bank. It's mind-blowing. It's $1,350 a second that they made in profits. You know, $80,000 a minute. And what people are saying is, if you take some of that money in the form of windfall profits and invest it in the development of alternative energy sources, we could become less addicted, to use the president's phrase, to petroleum from parts of the world where they just happen to be using our money to try and kill us.
Yeah, well, it all sounds very neat and tidy, but let me take your various points in turn as I can recollect them. In the first place, you're partly correct about OPEC. OPEC doesn't sit around and actually dictate a specific price. What it does is set production quotas.
But they do that with the idea to defining the price range.
And so OPEC, yes, OPEC is in a position massively to influence the global price of oil, but that also is affected by global demand. And OPEC, the International Energy Agency, our own Energy Information Administration, they were all taken by surprise in 2004 by the growth in global demand for petroleum, especially in China, but also even in the United States. And it was that mismatch in production, planned production, which includes, of course, OPEC, who collectively make up the single biggest producer, with surging demand that made crude oil prices grow so rapidly. And I would point out the obvious to your listeners, which is that none of our oil companies is a member of OPEC. OPEC is, to a great extent, a price setter. Our oil companies are price takers. That's
no, I understand all that, but our oil companies are, because they're saying, okay, if a barrel of crude oil goes up by a certain amount, then we're going to crank up the price of gasoline by a corresponding amount. And so last year we had $1 billion profit. This year we'll have $2 billion profit. You know, their profits are going up. What's wrong with saying, hey, guys, we don't mind if you're profitable. In fact, we think that that's a wonderful thing. But if you're going to make these kinds of mind-boggling profits, off a fossil fuel that is really a depleting industry that should be the heritage of all humans, then we're going to take some of that money and develop alternative energy sources with it. What's wrong with that?
Well, because it's just stealing. That's what's wrong with it. I mean, the
it's just taxation. Do you think all taxation
cyclical.
Is stealing, Marlo?
Let me answer your question. The oil industry is a highly cyclical business. If you remember in the late 90s, the price of crude oil fell to $10 a barrel, and all our oil companies took a bath. Their profits were way down, especially compared to the previous years. Now, if the oil companies were so high and mighty as you're making out, and they had such a capacity to manipulate the market, to jack up prices, to gouge consumers, they would never have let oil fall to $10 a barrel, but it did. And they took a bath. Now, if you're going to invest money, if you're a shareholder and you're going to invest money in a company that is in such a high-risk business where one year the price of your product can sell for $10 and the next year for $70, the only reason why you invest is because you hope and expect that after it falls to 10, it might go up as high as 70.
Marlo, you're conflating the oil producers with the oil companies. You just said a minute ago they're different.
All right. So my point is that if you then have a government policy which institutes what I would call one-way capitalism, which is that you can lose if the market price for your product falls, but you can't gain if the market price increases, nobody will want to invest in it, and then we'll have less oil supply, and then we'll have higher gasoline prices, because price is a function
of supply. Right, and then we'll have alternative energy sources being developed, and we'll have less carbon dioxide emissions, and we'll have less threat from global warming, and wouldn't that
be
a good thing?
Those alternative energy sources have been subsidized by the federal government for three decades, and we have almost nothing to show for it. Despite, you know, whether you like it or not, the petroleum remains the best value source for transportation fuel that the world has devised.
That's assuming
it remains today the best buy for the consumer dollar.
That's assuming that there is no global warming, there is no consequence to the use of fossil fuels, and that there's no expense associated with it. But your point is well taken. Marlo Lewis, I'm sorry we're out of time, but a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. I appreciate you coming on. It's good talking with you. You give as good as you get. I like that.
Okay, Tom.
16
likewise.
Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, I took a walk around the world to ease my troubled mind. I left my body lying somewhere in the sands of time. But I watched the world go to the dark side of the moon. I feel there's nothing I can do.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Yeah, there's something you can do. You can get politically active. Get out there and participate. Show up at your local county Democratic or Republican party or Green party or Progressive party or Libertarian. I don't care what the party is. Get involved. We need people of all political stripes who are people of goodwill, who really care about the issues. Ideally, obviously, I'd like to see progressives taking back the Democratic Party. But I know that, you know, we have listeners to this program. In fact, we get calls from them occasionally. I get emails from them. They hang out on our message board, which you can get to, by the way, going to tomhartman.com. You can also drop into our live chat room there, who are Republicans. And I would like to see some good, honest people take back the Republican Party, because it has become a cesspool. It has become the party of corruption. For example, here you had on the House Appropriations Committee, Duke Cunningham, okay, Randy Duke Cunningham, on the House Appropriations Committee, the committee that, how would you say it, organizes, you know, how money is going to be passed out, basically. I mean, if you look at the Constitution, powers granted to Congress. We're looking at Section 8 of Article 1 of the Constitution. Article 1 of the Constitution is about the legislative branch, because it's, in the minds of the founders, the most important branch, because it was the branch that was directly elected by the people. It's the closest to the people. The president was, there was a layer of insulation there with the Electoral College. The judiciary is appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. So the one that was closest to the people, the legislative branch, and if you look at Section 8 of the Constitution, it is titled Powers Granted to Congress. And it starts right out. It says, Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duty, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. And then they go through to borrow money on the credit of the United States, to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes, to establish a uniform rule of naturalization, to coin money, you know, and it goes on through the list, to declare war. I mean, these are things that only Congress can do. So if only Congress, the president doesn't have the power to authorize to quote lay and collect taxes, debts, duties, and excises, and pay debts and provide for the common defense, et cetera, in other words, the president doesn't have the power under the Constitution to raise taxes, lower taxes, in other words, to get money for the government, nor to spend money for the government. He can propose a budget. It's not in the Constitution that he has to. It's just tradition. He can propose a budget. And Congress can say, cool. Or they can say, no, don't think so. As happens all the time. And, of course, the judiciary has nothing to do with the budget. So it's all in the hands of Congress. And it begins with the House of Representatives. This is, you know, where Congress begins the process of spending money. And so being on the House Appropriations Committee, an appropriation being, hey, let's take some tax money and spend it, right? Being on the House Appropriations Committee is the creme de la creme. It's the ultimate power perk. You get a lot of juice from being on the Defense Appropriations Committee, for example. I mean, you know, because there's the big budget there. But the House Appropriations Committee, this is the, you know, one of the big enchiladas. And so the Republicans, they had, you know, Randy Duke Cunningham on the House Appropriations Committee, and he wanders off tearfully into the sunset. Well, actually, off to prison for taking bribes. Fine Republican tradition. Usually they call it lobbying or the K Street Project or something like that. And so the Republican leadership is looking around and they're saying, okay, you know, we're in the middle of a crisis here. We've got the whole Abramoff scandal breaking. We've got several, you know, a couple of Abramoff's guys being indicted. We've got Republicans being indicted. We've got, you know, high crimes and misdemeanors coming out our ears. And what are we going to do? Who are we going to put on the House Appropriations Committee? Seems like it would be a good idea to put somebody there of high ethical standards, don't you think? I mean, you know, find a member of Congress who's pretty unimpeachable, somebody who has solid principles. Even a good conservative Republican, like, for example, Ron Paul or Tom Tancredo, somebody who you know, pretty much talks straight. Even though I don't agree with how they talk straight. No, that's not what they did. That's not what they did at all. No, instead, what the Republicans did is they said, okay, we got this political plum, this incredibly juicy political plum, this incredibly powerful position, this seat on the House Appropriations Committee. Who are we going to give it to? Tom DeLay. They gave it to Tom DeLay. Can you believe that? I mean, it's just incredible. Tom DeLay gets on the House Appropriations Committee. In the meantime, Hillary Clinton stands up and she says, we are not going to be afraid. You are not going to cow us into fear. Did you get this yesterday? She accused Republicans of playing the fear card on terrorism. She says that Karl Rove said 2 weeks ago, all we've got is fear and we're going to keep playing the fear card. And she said, since when has it been part of American patriotism to keep our mouths shut? And so Hillary comes out and says, I'm not going to be afraid. The next thing you know, guess what? All the Republicans are huddled in the garage basement of the House of Representatives because the Senate because there's been a nerve gas alert. I can just see it now. Karl Rove over there, you know, dialing in, pushing the button or whatever. Let's scare the bejesus out of these guys. We'll show them. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I break tradition. Sometimes my tribes are outside the line. We've been conditioned to not make mistakes, but I can't live that way.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. Not only did the Republican, not only did this corrupt party that is now being run like, I mean, they should, the Democrats should be using the RICO Act, you know, the Racketeering Organized Crime Act against the Republican. They're being run like a mob family. Not only did they put Tom DeLay in charge of the powerful House Appropriations Committee, they also gave him a seat on the subcommittee that oversees the Justice Department, which, by coincidence, is now looking into, guess who? Tom DeLay! Well, indirectly. I mean, they're looking into Jack Abramoff and his dealings with lawmakers, and, you know, the main lawmaker there is Tom DeLay. So now Tom DeLay is on the subcommittee overseeing the Justice Department that's looking into the crimes of Jack Abramoff and his relationship with people like Tom DeLay. This subcommittee also, coincidentally, has responsibility for NASA, which just happens to have the Johnson Space Center located in Tom DeLay's district. They are doing everything they can to give this guy as much power, the power of the purse, so that he can bring home the bacon, pardon the string of cliches here, but I don't know how better to say it, so that he can, you know, he can extract more and more of our taxpayer dollars and dump them into Sugarland, Texas, and environs, into the Houston suburbs, his districts, Houston area, his district, so that he can try to pull this election out of the hat in 2006. And, you know, we'll see. I mean, will rigged voting machines be enough? I doubt it. But anyhow, that's what's up with Tom DeLay. In the meantime, this from Gannett News, or is it Gannett? I'm not sure. The news service. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist and House Speaker Dennis Hastert engineered a backroom legislative maneuver to protect pharmaceutical companies from lawsuits, say witnesses to the pre-Christmas power play. Yeah, just what the pharmaceutical companies need. If they screw up and kill us, we don't have the right to sue them anymore. Isn't that great? That's what they need. Well, that's what Bill Frist thought they needed. Of course, Bill Frist is one of the richest men in America, multi-billionaire. How? Through the health industry. What a surprise! What a surprise! And Bill, of course, a multimillionaire through the health industry. Yeah, he was a surgeon. He's also a businessman. In fact, his daddy's company, what was his father's company, I believe his brother is now the president of it, his brother Thomas, has paid the largest among, I don't know, maybe there's been a larger one now since then, but it was an $800 million fine for fraud against the United States government? This is the Frist family, right? The Frist family business. So anyhow, the article here by Bill Theobald with Gannett, the headline, Hastert Frist said to rig bill for drug firms. This is now coming out. This happened back during Christmas. This is just literally today coming out. The language was tucked into a Defense Department appropriations bill at the last minute without the approval of members of a House Senate conference committee, say several witnesses, including a top Republican staff member. See, even the Republican staffers are starting to have their stomachs turned by this stuff, by this level, this incredible level of corruption among these millionaires and billionaires in the Senate and the House and the lobbying firms and the big corporations that own them. In an interview, Frist, a doctor in Tennessee Republican, denied that the word was added that way. Trial lawyers and other groups condemned the law, saying it could make it nearly impossible for people harmed by a vaccine to force the drug maker to pay for their injuries. The legislation, called the Public Readiness and Emergency Preparedness Act, allows the Secretary of Health and Human Services to declare a public health emergency, which then provides immunity for companies that develop vaccines and other countermeasures. But beyond the issue of, notes the article in Gannett, beyond the issue of vaccine liability protection, some say going around the longstanding practice of bipartisan House-Senate conference committees working out compromises on legislation is a dangerous power grab by Republican congressional leaders that subverts democracy. The Brookings Institution, Thomas Mann, senior fellow, he said, it's a travesty of the legislative process. It vests enormous power in the hands of congressional leaders and private interests, minimizes transparency, and denies legitimate opportunities for all interested parties in Congress and outside to weigh in on important policy issues. This happened on December 18th as Congress was scrambling to finish their business. 38 senators and House members got together to work out the defense appropriation bill on that day. David Obey, the congressman from Wisconsin, said that the senator from Alaska, Ted Stevens, the conference chairman, told him, he said that he asked Stevens whether the vaccine liability language was in the massive bill or would be placed in it. Obey and four others at the meeting said Stevens said no, not there, and not going to be there. The committee members, therefore, all signed off on the bill, and the conference broke up. A spokeswoman for Stevens, Courtney Boone, said last week that the vaccine liability language was in the bill when the conferees approved it. Stevens was not made available for comment. But Keith Kennedy, who works for Senator Thad Cochran, this is a Republican of Mississippi, staff director for the Senate Appropriations Committee, said at a seminar for reporters last month that the language was inserted by Frist and Hastert after the conference committee ended its work. in a videotaped Washington, D.C. forum sponsored by the Center on Congress and Indiana Usury. Keep in mind, this is a Republican talking to Republicans. He said, there should be no dispute. That was an absolute travesty. It was added after the conference had concluded. It was added at the specific direction of the Speaker of the House and the Majority Leader of the Senate. That's Hastert and Frist. The conferees did not vote on it. It is a true travesty of the process. He said, Kennedy said, this is the Senator Thad Cochran, Republican of Mississippi, his director of his staff director, Keith Kennedy, said at the meeting, according to a congressional staffer, were Frist, Stevens, and House Majority Leader, Majority Whip Roy Blunt, and they, the committee staff members, were given the language, and then it was put in the document. At about 10:30 p.m., the Democratic staff members were handed the language and told it was now in the bill. Obie said he took it to the House floor in a rage. He called Hastert and Frist a couple of muscle men in Congress who think they have the right to tell everybody else that they have to do their bidding. Even Dan Burton, the Republican of Indiana, was critical of this. He said, he told Congress Daily, quote, it sucks, end quote. You've got Republicans saying this is wrong. And equally corrupt President George W. Bush signed the legislation into law December 30th. Why am I not surprised? Why am I not surprised? Our phone number, 1-866-889-8894. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartman.com, and you can pop right in there and hang out with some of the finest minds in the entire Internet. Estelle in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Estelle, welcome to the program.
Good morning. I'm hoping so very much that you know the answer to this question or can find out, and that is, why is the American military holding Iraqi women in prison or detained? Are they judge spies?
No. According to an article in the New York Times about a week ago, there were several pieces about this. When we released six of the people of the women that we were holding,
mm-hmm,
in an apparent, you know, they're saying it's not a quid pro quo, but in an attempt to get the release of this Christian Science Monitor reporter. Turns out that what had happened was these women were the wives of men who are suspected of being participants in the insurgency.
Yeah.
And so they were taken as hostage, and notes were delivered to their husbands saying, if you don't want your wife in the hands of the Americans, turn yourself in. And of course, the husbands, you know, it's common knowledge in Iraq, whether it's true or not is irrelevant. The common belief in Iraq is that women who fall into the hands of Americans are going to get the Abu Ghraib treatment. They're going to be defiled. They're going to be raped. They're going to be humiliated, etc. And so the hope was that this would sufficiently intimidate their husbands into turning themselves in. Instead, what it's doing is it's causing Iraq to so hate us, the average Iraqis, that now 80% of Iraqis think it's appropriate to shoot at Americans when they go by. And, you know, the big point, you can't have an insurgency without popular support. It's simply not possible. The American Revolution couldn't have happened if there weren't people willing to hide the revolutionaries. You can't have an insurgency without popular support. Estelle, thanks for the call. It's good to hear from you. Judy in Dana Point, California. Hey, Judy, welcome to the program. We have about a minute before we've got to take a break. What's up?
Okay. Hi, Tom. I was wondering if you were aware that in the budget that Bush put in, the Social Security, taking money out of Social Security for the privatization.
Yes. It's in my stack of things I was going to rant about today, Judy. It's absolutely mind-boggling, isn't it? He actually has his privatization of Social Security. He goes before the State of the Union, and he says, oh, we're going to have a bipartisan commission. But right in his budget is the whole privatization program. It's all laid out. There's $800 billion set aside for this, that. You know, let's give some money to Wall Street, all this, that, and the other thing. It's all right there.
I know.
It's all right there, and they're just discovering it today. I mean, people are just finally reading the budget. The New York Times wrote a piece about it today,
yeah.
Finally.
I think that he probably was hoping that the congressman wouldn't read the budget and just pass it. I mean, sometimes you wonder if they do read it.
No, I think that, you know, he knows that they're going to read it. I think that this is just another symptom of the incredible hubris of this guy and this administration. They just think that they can do anything, and even if it's their own party, they don't care what comes
just,
out of it.
It's so disheartening. I can't even go there. I am so frustrated.
It's pretty grim, Judy, and what it should do for all of us, and thank you for your call, is it should energize us to get out there and get politically active. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Johnny wanna be a big star, get on stage and play the guitar, make a little money by playing the car, a big old house and an alligator. Sister Max with them alligator shoes, he's a rich man so he's no longer singing the blues. He's singing songs about material things, man, clapping rings and watching the gold blaze. But
must be the Jack Abramoff song. Welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. The Tom Hartman radio program, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting for a Change, as in let's change this country. Lou in Fayetteville, Arkansas on the line. Hey, Lou, what's up?
Well, what's happening? I was just, I think earlier you mentioned something about the budget and retirement, that young lady that called in. But I was listening to C-SPAN a couple mornings ago, and they were reading some of the things in the budget. Now, I'm a retiree, former police officer. I live in Fayetteville, and there's a lot of homeless here in Fayetteville, Arkansas, and 30% of them are veterans. And a lot of these people, when they die, they have relied on one thing, and that's the what they call the burial money from Social Security.
That's right.
They've taken it out of this budget.
Yeah, Bush has pulled it out of his budget.
Yeah, $255.
He's also pulled out of his budget. If you are a child and you are orphaned, your parents die, and you drop out of high school, you don't get Social Security benefits.
Yeah, so they get you both ways.
So if you have to go to work,
when you're old,
if you decide that you have to go to work or something like that, you're toast.
Yeah, but at the same time, they're still allowing $700 billion when. Tax breaks for the rich buddies.
Oh yeah, $70 billion and $60 to $70 billion in tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires, and an $8 billion gift to the energy industry this year.
Yeah, but if you
but they're compassionate conservatives though.
Yeah, but if you happen to be poor and die, then I guess they send you out to the dump now.
It wouldn't surprise me.
One little question. Is it strange to you, or is it just me with my conspiratorial mind? That with all of these things coming up, all of a sudden this information about this cartoon that came out last September.
Yeah.
Now all of a sudden they've got riots around the Muslim world.
Right.
And knowing how the CIA has instigated situations like this before, could there possibly be some little correlation at the same time that Bush is under fire for his wiretapping?
You know, it's not inconceivable. I suspect, though, if you're looking for a conspiracy, look to the right wingers in the Muslim world for whipping this thing up, doing the same thing that the Falwell bunch does. You know, the gays are coming to get us; they want to get married, for example. They use it as a fundraising tool, as a way of galvanizing the troops. And I suspect that the Islamic radical right wingers are doing the same thing that the American Christian right wingers do, only they're doing it with their little shtick. You know, remember back during the Reagan administration when there was an art gallery in New York City had a display where there was a crucifix and a cup of urine. Do you remember that?
Very well,
they went ballistic on that thing. Now, we didn't have people in the streets, and they weren't killing each other, but I'm telling you, the right wing probably raised $20 million off that thing by sending out mailers to all their base saying, how dare they? They're defiling Jesus, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, that would be my guess. I'm firmly of the opinion that Bush is going to gin up a war in time for the 2006 election. Yeah. And as I've been saying all along, I think it's going to be with Syria, because I don't think that he has yet the strength to fight a war with Iran.
It's strange to me. I recall his axes of evil speech.
Yeah.
And I recall also that Iran, now just 2 weeks ago, Iran unsealed.
Yeah, I know.
Does it unseal mean that they were sealed?
Yeah, they had been, and they were voluntarily sealed. By the way, Iran did all of that voluntarily. There is no UN resolution that says that Iran has to keep its program transparent. Iran has done that entirely voluntarily up till now, and that's why Bush is talking about going to the UN to get a resolution saying that they have to. And this is the
thing is, this all came about after his so-called axes of evil, and then an invasion of Iraq, which any normal-minded person, if we were sitting here and Canada made a axes of evil speech against us and then invaded Mexico, don't you think we might gear up our...
We'd get a little weird. Yeah, we certainly would. Yeah, Lou, you make a good point, and I appreciate the call. It's you know, well said. We would definitely get a little weird. And by the way, that was right after Saddam Hussein. We invaded Iraq right after Saddam Hussein said he was going to start denominating his oil sales in euros. And now the Iranians say in March they're going to start denominating their oil sales in euros. And that's the one thing that's causing me to think that maybe Bush is going to go after Iran before March. Nate in St. Cloud, Minnesota. Hey, Nate, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to, I can't help but think when you were talking about the parties and we should revitalize the Democratic Party and move it to the progressives. And I can't help but think about the anti-Mason party in American history. And
back in the 1870s, or 1890s, rather.
Yeah, and they cleaned up the whole system from what my little history book says. And
well, keep in mind, you know, Washington and most of his friends, Franklin certainly, there's no evidence of Jefferson that I've been able to find, but most of those guys were Masons. I mean, the swearing-in ceremony for George Washington was a Masonic parade.
So, yeah, and
the U.S., early U.S. symbology is full of Masonic symbols.
Oh, yeah, and
I'm not sure that that was a bad thing, by the way. I'm not saying this is, you know, I just don't know.
Would you be for a anti-Skull and Bones movement, or?
Yeah, I'd sign on for that.
Because wasn't John the bummer is wasn't John Kerry Skull and Bones? I remember.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, he was. He was. I still think he would have made a great president, even though he was in Skull and Bones, though.
Oh,
I don't think that. And maybe I'm wrong. I don't know, but I just don't think that being in Skull and Bones is as deep a thing into a person's soul as your political party and the lifetime of work that you've done. I hope I'm wrong. I hope I'm right, rather, and that the conspiracy theorists are wrong on that one. We'll see. Anyhow, just to wrap this thing up, let's return the oil profits to the American people. I just want to put this meme out, windfall profits tax. We could create a huge energy business in this country with that. 57 minutes.
Thanks to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you, helping you win the water cooler wars. Lynn Landis is a freelance journalist who specializes in voting, the environment, and health issues. One of the nation's leading journalists on voting technology and democracy issues. She's featured in the book Black Box Voting by Bev Harris. Her website is ecotalk.org. Lynn Landis, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
I understand, Lynn, that you have a case which is going before the United States Supreme Court.
Yes, it is at the court. It's docket number 05930. It's yet to be determined whether they're going to take any arguments on it or whether they're going to let the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, their ruling, stand. It was about a year and a half ago in July of 2004 that I filed the suit, and the suit is basically challenging local, state, and federal laws in Pennsylvania that allow the use of non-transparent voting systems to include voting machines and absentee voting. And what's been happening so far is the district court and the Court of Appeals are denying me standing, which is a little unusual. Susan Murray,
you're a voter, are you not?
I'm a voter and I'm a journalist, and that's how I describe myself in the suit. It's interesting that the cases they're using against me have nothing to do with challenging the constitutionality of laws. One's a takings case, the other one is a patient's rights case, and the third one is a sexual discrimination on the job case. It's very strange.
Well, sometimes they'll do that in an effort to spin what you're proposing away from, you know, in other words, to reframe what your argument is.
Well, it's interesting because this issue came up in the Alito hearings when Senator Sessions suggested to Sam Alito that perhaps he would like to revisit Marbury versus Madison, the 1803 decision that where the court, the Supreme Court, took upon itself the right to judge the constitutionality of legislative acts. So this is a really big deal. In other words, the Third Circuit, I don't believe wants people like me, or anyone for that matter, to challenge the constitutionality of laws. And this is a huge, huge deal, just that aspect of the case.
Yeah, let's just boil this down to plain English for our listeners who may not be familiar with some of the arcana here. Basically, what you're suggesting, if my understanding and my reading of what I have on the case that you have that's on the U.S. Supreme Court docket, which doesn't mean that the court is going to hear the arguments. It means that they're going to decide whether or not to hear the arguments.
Correct.
If my understanding of it is correct, basically what you're saying, you're suing Alberto Gonzalez at the federal level and your state and county election officials, and you're saying you are violating, that they are violating your constitutional right to have a transparent voting process available to you by bringing in electronic voting machines where a private corporation, or even for that matter, if it was done by the government, where the vote is actually counted in the dark of a chip.
Yes, and even more so, the challenge is to the use of any and all voting machines, and that includes ballot scanners, because mm-hmm. they introduce concealment to the process just
right.
inherently.
In other words, you want to take us back to doing it the way Canada just did it in their national elections just a few weeks ago, pencil on paper, human beings counting the votes.
Yes, and historically, you know, we used to vote before the Civil War. Not coincidentally, I think, before the Civil War, voting was a public and transparent process. There were no voting machines, there was no secret ballot, there was no absentee voting. All this occurred after the Civil War as the voting franchise was being expanded to African Americans, women, and other minority groups.
Well, my understanding is that the private ballot, the secret ballot, was introduced during Reconstruction in large part. It used to be that basically what would happen is people would gather in the city hall and they would say, somebody would stand, you know, whoever was running the vote would say, you know, who's in favor of so-and-so, and people would raise their hand and they'd tally it on a board or somebody would write it down on a piece of paper. And that after the Civil War, the wounds and the divisions in the United States were so deep that particularly in the border states, in the, you know, along the Mason-Dixon line, that they didn't want people to expose themselves to possible retribution by voting for particular candidates publicly, and so the private ballot was brought in. That's at least the rationale. Now, I know that there are also historians who suspect that the reason that the private ballot was brought in was so that it would be easier to stuff ballot boxes.
Oh, yes. It's a gift to elections officials, because there you have a pile of anonymous ballots that you can really do anything you want with. And I think that, you know, if you were going to accept the rationale that this somehow protects the voter, then you wouldn't have them registering with the different parties either, if you're going to, you know, be consistent.
Right.
But the case is not about the secret ballot. I've really come to that decision of being against the secret ballot after I filed the case, and it's just something that I have on my website. And in fact, in January of last year, I wrote an article suggesting that people run parallel elections. In other words, they set up tables outside of the polling places and ask people to vote twice, once inside, once outside, and sign that ballot so that there could be a second, body of evidence as to what the voters really intended. And amazingly, I personally couldn't organize my way out of a paper bag, but amazingly, activists in three states, Texas, California, and Florida, have been organizing these elections, and they have discovered some interesting patterns. For instance, in San Diego, 11 precincts participated. They had over 50% participation rate, and in fact, more participation by Republicans than Democrats. And what they found was, comparing their results to the official results, they determined that there was a 3% shift in all of those 11 counties from the Democratic column to the Republican column. And they actually had TV cameras there. They actually won a recount. And as I understand it, the result of the recount was that all the other precincts that did not have the parallel election had, you know, a perfect recount. There were no problems. But in every one of the precincts with the parallel elections, there were minor problems. But, of course, by that time, elections officials had had their hands on the ballots for weeks.
Right.
So you really, recounts are of anonymous ballots, whether they're electronic or paper, are really hardly of any use whatsoever. You really,
like,
if you have a problem, you need a re-election, not a recount.
I was going to say, it sounds like what you're suggesting, Lynn Landis, ecotalk.org, your website, that our entire electoral system, I mean, this goes way beyond the privatization of the vote with electronic machines. Our entire electoral system has been corrupted.
Right. And the other thing also is that with the voting machines, they really are a modern-day literacy test for many people, except it's computer literacy that's the test, not just for the voters, but also for the elections officials. So that, you know, whatever a machine produces, whether it's simply a tally or it's a ballot, electronic or paper, whatever it produces, and this is what I put in my lawsuit, is direct evidence that the machine did something, but it's circumstantial evidence at best of the voter's intent.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason to have an obstacle between you and your ballot. So the case is really about direct access to a ballot and meaningful oversight, meaningful transparency to the process.
So when are you going to find out, Lynn, we have about a minute and a half left here.
Sure.
I'm wondering when you're going to find out whether the Supreme Court is actually going to hear your case, because so far you've been losing, right?
That's the downside of making it to the Supreme Court. The response time deadline for the defendants to answer is February 24th. And then after that, I'm not really very certain of the timeline, but I would say within a month or two afterwards, I'll find out whether they're going to take it up or not.
And you're defending yourself in this case?
I'm representing myself pro se. I could not attract any legal talent to this case, unbelievably. And I think you and your listeners know that there's something wrong with the Democratic Party and ACLU and NAACP.
I'm surprised lawyers like Bob Fitrakis and Harvey Wasserman wouldn't jump in with you on this.
No, they haven't. They've got their own fish to fry, and they're doing a great job.
They are very busy there in
Ohio.
They've got a lot of their
plate. But one other thing I wanted to also let your viewers know is in about a week or two, when my husband figures out how to do this, we have videotape of the Danaher voting machine company representative admitting that next to every candidate's name is a political party designator, so they don't need to know all the names on the ballots or their positions. All they need to do is prefer one political party over the other, and company insiders can easily rig the elections nationwide.
Holy cow. And you can find out more about this at ecotalk.org, right?
Yes.
Okay. Lynn Landis, ecotalk.org. Good luck before the Supreme Court. Let us know what happens, eh?
Thank you very much, Tom.
Great talking to you, Lynn. It's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Thank you very much for that beautiful thing. See, my friends, if you want to become part of the middle class, you have to learn Chinese. In 2050, this from the Xuanet News Service of China, in 2050, 1.3 billion Chinese will live in a moderately developed society with a minimum monthly income, an average life expectancy of more than 80 years, and social services available to all, according to a new report from the Chinese Academy of Sciences. By then, no one in China will live with an annual income less than the country's absolute poverty line. As the Xinhua News Service reports, the New York Times of China, as it were, Chinese society is now undergoing the first stage of its transformation towards an industrialized society, adding the economic modernization in China has been faster than the social modernization over the past 50 years. Well, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, ready to learn Chinese with me?
Well, I would love to, Tom, but I've got a real treat for you if you're in the mood for it.
Oh, great. Okay.
We're at the Conservative Political Action Conference.
Yes.
And I have for you Gordon James Klingenschmidt, who is the Navy chaplain who went on the hunger strike after being told he couldn't pray in Jesus' name.
Okay.
Would you like to speak with him?
Sure.
Okay, he's right here. Here we go.
Am I on the air? Yes, you are. Hello, this is Navy Chaplain Gordon James Klingenschmidt.
Well, hello, Chaplain Klingenschmidt. Pleased to talk with you. You went on a fast because you were not allowed to pray in Jesus' name. I don't understand.
Well, the U.S. Navy has this policy. They say you can pray in Jesus' name in private settings, like maybe in the chapel, but don't let Jesus out of the chapel. Heavens no. If you pray in Jesus' name in public, where sailors of other faiths might hear you, then the Chief of Navy Chaplain says you're being insensitive and you're denigrating other faiths. And so when I wanted to pray in Jesus' name, they allowed me to do so, but they punished me later on. The commanding officer told the Navy Board to end my career because I ended my prayers in Jesus' name.
You know, in the Sermon on the Mount, as I recall, it gets into about the 8th chapter of Matthew, Jesus says, don't be like the hypocrites who stand on the street corners praying with many words. I tell you, they have already received their reward. Instead, go into your closet, close the door, and pray secretly to God, who will reward you in secret. Aren't you doing the exact opposite by praying in Jesus' name in public of what Jesus told us all to do?
Heavens, no. Good grief. That we ought to be allowed to take turns and share a diversity of faith expressions. If we're going to have any kind of public expression of faith, then we ought to be allowed to, for example, let a Jewish chaplain pray to Adonai, let a Catholic chaplain pray in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, let a Muslim chaplain pray to Allah in public, and I'll take turns with them, and I'll only pray in Jesus' name the same way other military chaplains do.
But I'm just speaking to you as one Christian to another. Jesus Christ was very explicit in the Sermon on the Mount that if somebody is praying in public, they're doing it for theater and performance and for their own aggrandizement, and it's not something that is pleasing to God.
Well, I don't know about that. What you're
I'm assuming you've read
maybe
the Sermon on the Mount.
Right, but that's, I'm not.
Are you telling me that Jesus was wrong?
He didn't say you can't pray in public. He didn't say you can't preach the gospel in public. We're supposed to be a living witness. We're supposed to be salt and light out in the public.
It was Paul who talked about preaching the gospel, but and Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount spoke specifically about prayer. In fact, later on when he was in Gethsemane, he prayed in front of his disciples. The one time in the Bible where you see Jesus praying in front of his disciples, and he prefaces the prayer by saying, "I'm saying this prayer in front of people because part of it is for their benefit." So he's like, the one time that he breaks his own commandment not to pray out loud in public, he prefaces it by saying, I'm breaking my own suggestion. I mean, aren't you being a hypocrite in doing this, sir?
Well, I offered to not pray at all, but chaplains are, of course, invited to public ceremonies. They have a tradition on the ship where somebody comes on the ship every night and says on the ship's microphone a traditional prayer.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what chaplains do. This is what we're paid to do. It's part of our profession. And, you know, in John 15:15, Jesus said that if anyone prays to the Father in my name, that God will hear his prayers. And in John 14:6, Jesus said, I am the way and the truth and the life, and no one comes to the Father except through me. And so what I wanted to
but
pray...
But back in Matthew, Jesus said very clearly, if you pray in public, you're being a hypocrite. You're doing what the hypocrites do, and you're doing it for your own benefit, not for the benefit of God.
Well, we ought to allow sailors to publicly express their faith. Sailors don't forsake their First Amendment rights just because they put on a uniform. They don't have to, censor themselves or quiet themselves.
I don't disagree with you.
Forbid them.
I agree with you. I agree with you. And in fact, I think that this is reaching, frankly, a point of silliness. But with regard to the Navy saying, you can't talk about Jesus and a Muslim can't talk about Allah and all that sort of thing, I think, frankly, I'm on your side on this. And I have to say that I find, speaking as a Christian, I find Christians praying in public. I see Pat Robertson on TV doing these hyper-emotional prayers, and it looks to me like exactly what Jesus was condemning in the Sermon on the Mount.
Well, take that up with Pat, I guess. But
well, I'm taking it up with you because you're saying you're doing the same thing, and I thought I'd just raise the question.
I don't know. I just don't agree.
Okay. Well, We can agree to disagree. That's one of the wonderful things about the United States of America. Thank you so much for being with us, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Good speaking with you. And thank you, Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service. Great having you on. It's 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting for a Change.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I'm sorry. My Chinese is terrible. I only spent a month in China, and that was in 1986. In fact, I was walking around for the first week or so telling people the word in Chinese for diarrhea, thinking that I was saying thank you. And I got a lot of startled looks from people, I'll tell you. So Chinese, a polyphonic language. I didn't realize it, that your tonality, the tone that you drop into a word changes its meaning. And boy, did I screw things up. I thought I was, you know, I speak a little bit of Japanese, and I thought it was like Japanese where you could say konnichiwa, arigato gozaimashita, you know, whatever. And however you say it, it means the same thing. In Chinese, you can go ma. And you've got three different words, you know. So, well, how did I get off on that? Oh, it's the Chinese middle class and our Chinese lesson, our bumper music. There you go. And the folks in our chat room, I had no idea that Victoria Jones was going to hand me some poor chaplain with the Navy, who I believe in all of the, probably the best of intentions, you know, wants to do what he believes is his commission, which is, you know, go out and preach the gospel. And, you know, you have to salute people for having the courage of their faith, even although I would rather pay attention to what Jesus said rather than to what the preachers are saying, frankly, which is what I think Jesus was saying to do. It reminds me of the story. One of the folks in the chat room said, I'd rather dance. You know, why don't these televangelists, why don't they start dancing instead of praying? It's like the story of Jehoshaphat. Just a quick digression, but one that I'm sure you'll love this. Jehoshaphat, the king, he was the king of Israel at the time. And these two spies come to him and they say, we've got word that three different groups, I forget who it was, Ammonites, the Amorites, and the Canaanites or something like that. Anyhow, three different armies are massing on the other side of the mountain and they're going to attack us in the morning. And they're huge. They're going to wipe us out. And so Jehoshaphat goes and prays about it and goes to the high priest and says, you know, what should I do? And anyhow, God tells Jehoshaphat, march into battle in the morning, but put the priests in the front and put you in front of the priests and go in there dancing and singing. And so Jehoshaphat is like, he's not real happy with this advice. But, you know, this is what he was told to do. So he does it. And all the way up, he's dancing and he's singing this, Hodu Ladonai Kitov Kila Alam Hasto, which is Hebrew for praise God for his mercy endures forever. And, you know, just over and over and over again saying that. And basically he was saying, you know, please God, don't let them kill me. And he gets up to the top of the mountain and looks over and sees that during the night the three armies collided with each other and fought with each other and everybody's dead and there's all these goodies. And the moral of the story is, you know, dance. That's where the phrase jump at Jehoshaphat came from. So to follow up on the conversation in the chat room. Anyhow, back to politics. It's, I think, important that we do this. Bush's Social Security sleight of hand. Alan Sloan wrote this. If you read enough numbers, he says, you never know what you'll find. Take President Bush and private Social Security accounts. This is the, you know, kind of to segue off Christianity, this is the anti-Christian dimension of the Bush administration, of the whole Republican agenda. You know, the message of Christianity, the message of Judaism, with the concept of tikkun, that we are born into the world with an obligation to heal the world, the message, a very large message in the Quran, one of the more significant messages of Hinduism, and certainly a core message of Buddhism, is that we must have compassion, that we must be available for the least among us. And the Bush administration, no, they're available for the richest among us, and the least among us, let them eat cake, right? As Marie Antoinette said, you know, cake, by the way, back in those days was the word to describe the crumbs that fell off the edge of bread when you baked bread, and it would rise higher than the top of the pan, and parts of it would drip off onto the floor of the oven and burn. That was the cake that she was referring to. In any case, here's the Bush administration. Bush stuck a big Social Security privatization plan in the federal budget proposal, which he sent to Congress on Monday. His plan would let people set up private accounts, this from Alan Sloan's piece, starting in 2010, and would divert more than $700 billion of Social Security tax revenues to pay for them over the first 7 years. He asked Congress to, quote, join me in creating a commission to examine the full impact of baby boom recipient retirements on Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and said this is going to be bipartisan and offer bipartisan solutions. Right. George W. Bush, once again, lying through his teeth, this time in the State of the Union address. Well, he's done it before in the State of the Union address. We know that there's uranium and, you know, yeah. Anyone who thought Bush would vote for or wait for bipartisanship needs to be waiting for, you know what, the Earth to go flying away from the sun and end up in some other solar system. Instead, he put his own private privatization proposals, right into the budget. You look, it's right on page 321 of Bush's budget proposal. Privatization costs $24.182 billion in fiscal 2010, $57.429 billion fiscal 2011, $630.533 billion over the 5 years after that, for a seven-year total of $712 billion that George Bush wants to take from our Social Security payments that are not made, by the way, by millionaires and billionaires. You only pay Social Security now on your first, I think it's $90,000 of income. After that, you pay nothing. So it's just the working class of America, it's just working people in America who are paying into Social Security, and Bush wants to make sure that $712 billion of that goes to make his privatization program work. And in the process, of course, an awful lot of that money, the vast majority of it, is going to end up in the hands of Wall Street bankers and brokers who are, oddly enough, just by coincidence, among the largest contributors to Bush's 2004 election campaign. What, you know, I'm shocked. Gambling in Casablanca, I'm shocked. Yeah. Social Security, Bush called these voluntary private accounts, maximum contribution starting at $1,100 a year and rising by $100 a year through 2016. Yes, that's going to help me retire real big time if I can set aside $1,100. We already have private retirement accounts. They're called IRAs. They're called SEP accounts. They're called 401Ks. We already have them. What this is an attempt to destroy Social Security, pure and simple. This has been George W. Bush's personal agenda since he ran for Congress in the 1970s. Back in the 1970s, when he ran for Congress in Texas and lost, his main campaign platform was privatizing Social Security. And back then, he at least had the honesty to call it privatizing Social Security. But what he discovered was, that's not what people want. And so he lost. So we'll see how that shakes out. Revenue from corporate taxes could decline. This from the Wall Street Journal. Bush's 2007 budget, again back looking at his budget, anticipates a decline in corporate income tax revenue next year. Gee, what a surprise. Corporations are going to pay less. And while a growing economy and corporate profits will boost corporate tax receipts in later years, corporate taxes will continue to shrink, writes Robert Guy Matthews in the Wall Street Journal, as a percentage of federal revenue if the president has his way. He goes on to note, this is the Wall Street Journal. I mean, this is the rich talking to the rich, right? Next year's decline would follow an unusual spike in taxable corporate profits and revenues that reflects the expiration of temporary investment tax breaks enacted in 2002 and 2003. And then they go through all the numbers and everything. And so here we have George W. Bush. Once again, more tax breaks for millionaires, billionaires, and corporations. As the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities points out, Treasury Department figures show that actual corporate income tax revenues fell to $132 billion in 2003, down 36% from $207 billion in 2000, the year before Bush came into office. So Bush has his tax cuts. Guess what happens? There's less tax revenue. Now, Bush told us it wasn't going to work that way. Remember? He told us that he was going to cut taxes and there would be more receipts in the federal Treasury. It has never worked that way in the history of the country, but he told us it would work that way. Once again, Bush lied. As a result of these low levels, corporate revenues in 2003 represent only 1.2% of gross domestic product, the lowest level since 1983, which, by the way, was an anomalous year, the year in which a Reagan year. Again, Reagan slashed taxes, corporate taxes, and guess what? The federal government went into debt. In 2003 was the lowest since 83, and 83 was the lowest year since the 1930s, since the Great Depression. Yes, the Republican Great Depression, brought to you courtesy of the Republican Party and Herbert Hoover, whose campaign slogan in 1932 was, "Prosperity is just around the corner." The Republican Great Depression being repeated here in 2006 as we come along. I'm telling you, the only thing that's causing it not to look like the Great Depression out there is the fact that Bush is borrowing $2 billion a day and spending it to cover up the fact that we have an economic disaster as a result of his insane policies, not to mention the insane trade policies brought to you courtesy of Bill Clinton. Corporate revenues represent only 7.4% of all federal tax receipts in 2003, with the exception of 1983. This represents the lowest level on record, and the data goes back to 1934. This is incredible. According to the OMB, the Office of Management and Budget historical data, corporate taxes averaged 2% of GDP in the 1990s. That represents only about 2/5 of their share of GDP in the 1950s. So corporations in the 1950s were paying more than twice as much as a share of GDP as they are now. More than twice as much in the 1960s. A quarter more than in the 1970s. But Ronald Reagan changed all that. 28% of federal revenues in the 1950s came from corporations. Now it's about 10%. And heading down. And you wonder why CEOs are making 500 times what the average person makes. 45 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Now we're back to English. Welcome back, my friends. And we do live in a beautiful world. And we have an obligation to make it a more beautiful world. That's what comes with this extraordinary gift of life. Welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 9 minutes before the hour. Program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-5111-MACS. And tell them I said hi. You can get the latest iPods and all things electronic, all things Macintosh, certainly, and most things computer. You can also check it out at smalldog.com on the Internet. Andrea Thomas writes in today's Wall Street Journal. Actually, I believe this might have been yesterday's Wall Street Journal, but in any case, with many of Germany's companies posting record profits, the country's 3.4 million workers in the metals and electronics sector are expected to end their period of concessions and go back to demanding robust wage gains in talks that began this week. IG Metall, the powerful manufacturing trade union, is seeking a 5% increase, more than four times what employers group Gestamp Metall is offering. Their negotiations, which usually serve as a bellwether for the German economy, start Wednesday. And German workers and unions have responded to globalization more actively than in other Eurozone countries, notes Andrea Thomas in the Wall Street Journal, exercising wage restraint and, in some landmark instances, accepting more work hours without pay increases in deals that kept productivity or production from being moved out of the country. But real income has declined over the last 4 years. See, the conservative Kool-Aid, the economic Kool-Aid that Bill Clinton drank, that Reagan drank, that Bush Sr. drank, that Bush Jr. drank, that Tony Blair drank, that Margaret Thatcher was passing out, that conservative economic Kool-Aid, they've been drinking it in Germany, they've been drinking it in France, they've been drinking it in many of the European countries, and guess what? Their middle classes are getting wiped out. But in Germany, they're saying, no, Gross profits of German companies rose 21%, but real income has declined over the past 4 years, and workers' net take-home pay has declined by 0.9%. Now, says Andrea Thomas, workers are looking to capture a bigger share of the profits. Yes. And it's just incredible to me that in the United States, workers, by and large, are striking to simply keep what they have or to have 80% of what they had. You know, please, instead of slashing our wages from $20 an hour to $10 an hour, slash them only from $20 to $15 an hour. Or please, instead of taking our health insurance entirely away, just give us that stuff with the $5,000 deductible. What happened to the race to the top? We are in the middle of a race to the bottom that started when Ronald Reagan in 1981 declared war on the middle class and on working people in the United States. It has been going on relentlessly for 25 years. And it's time for Americans to stand up and say, no, enough already. We've had enough of it. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Maureen in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Seattle. Hey, Maureen, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Actually, two questions. And the first one has to do with what you were just talking about with we as citizens standing up. And you know, for many of us who are now getting really involved with different organizations and have been voting, et cetera, it feels like it's such a slippery slope between now and November, with every day something more controversial or just totally unethical.
Yeah, they're
happening.
Testing things right now. The cons are tossing things out to see what works in small ways all around the country, and then you know, come October. Probably October, they're going to roll out some sort of huge surprise, whatever it's going to be, whether it's going to be, I don't think it's going to be something they've tried before, like flag burning. We'll see.
Sorry,
it might be a war. My guess is it's going to be a war.
But what can we as citizens do in addition to, I mean, what can we, as a large voice, I mean, I keep hearing people say, well, why aren't Americans getting angry? Well, we are angry, but in addition to the voting and being involved with things, what can we do to help stop what is this slippery slope right now?
Well, I think that
that's what I'm asking.
I think we need to be finding candidates at the local level, and let's think long term, right? I mean, remember that the modern conservative, so-called Republican, so-called conservative bunch started back 25 years ago with Ralph Reed and Jerry Falwell and these guys organizing literally at the level of the local church.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's really where it began. Local churches and local county wards, and they said, well, let's take over the Republican Party from the inside. And they were looking at it in the long view, and they reaped the results. And so I think getting involved with local politics, getting involved in showing up for literally the local county Democratic Party event, call the local party and say, you know, can I volunteer one day a week,
right,
or, you know, when's the next meeting? Can I give you $15 or $50 or whatever, you know, you can afford? Getting involved in building that infrastructure is step one. And if there's a strong Green Party in your area, getting involved with them too. The Green Party has been very, very, you know, powerful positive force, particularly in local and state level around the United States, and moving politics in a more progressive direction. But I think we need to do both, frankly. I don't see the two as mutually exclusive. I know some people do, many Greens do, but I don't. And
okay, so it's just thinking long term and being involved now
we're in this to you know, I hate military metaphors, but I don't have a better one, so I'll just have to use it. I mean, you know, we're in this to win the war, and there may be a few battles we'll lose along the way, but we're in it for the long haul. Or we're in this to bring in the big garden, and you know, if the mites get a few of our tomatoes on the way, you know, whatever. I pick your metaphor, but you get what I'm saying, Maureen.
I do. I have another question. May I ask it?
We're out of time. I mean, you can toss out something in about 5 seconds.
Okay.
But yeah, okay. I guess it's going to take you more than that, so we're out of time. I appreciate you calling in, Maureen. Call in again. You know, later on in the week, next week, we'll pick it up again. It's 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where being progressive never felt so good. We'll be back.
You've been been listening to the Tom Hartman Program, check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you in the real free speech zone. No barbed wire fences, no police officers putting their gun in your face if you try to leave the premises and go over there where the president is. No siree, Bob. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program. This breaking news from the National Journal, which the last time I looked, I may be wrong, but I believe is a conservative publication. Correct me if I'm wrong, David. I'm pretty sure National Journal is a conservative publication. This just in, as they say. Although, hey, David, this is clipped off, chopped off. I'll read you what I can of it. Vice President Dick Cheney's former chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby, testified to a federal grand, presumably jury, that he had been authorized by Cheney and other White House superiors in the summer of 2003 to disclose, presumably, well, David's getting me the whole story here. The piece I have here is just, it's chopped up, and so we'll have the whole thing. Pretty startling, though. It looks like Libby basically laid it out. That when George W. Bush, you recall, George W. Bush, about the leak, you know, leaking Valerie Plame and all that kind of thing. George W. Bush's comment, of course, was...
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Yeah, well, apparently somebody had an idea. Here we are. This is the National Journal article by Mari Waas, W-A-A-S. Vice President Dick Cheney's former chief of staff, I. Louis Scooter Libby, testified to a federal grand jury that he had been authorized, and that's in quotes, by Cheney and other White House, quote, superiors, end quote, in the summer of 2003 to disclose classified information to journalists to defend the Bush administration's use of pre-war intelligence in making the case to go to war with Iraq, according to attorneys familiar with the matter and according to court records. This is huge. Libby specifically claimed that in one instance he had been authorized to divulge portions of a then-still highly classified national intelligence estimate regarding Saddam Hussein's purported efforts to develop nuclear weapons, according to correspondence recently filed in federal court by Special Prosecutor Patrick J. Fitzgerald. Beyond what was stated in the court papers, say people with firsthand knowledge of the matter, Libby also indicated that he will offer as a broad defense during his upcoming criminal trial that Vice President Cheney and other senior Bush administration officials had earlier encouraged and authorized him to share classified information with journalists to build public support for going to war. Later, after the war began in 2003, Cheney authorized Libby to release additional classified information, including details of the National Intelligence Estimate, to defend the administration's use of pre-war intelligence in making the case for war. This is, as they say, a bombshell. Libby testified to the grand jury that he had been authorized to share parts of the National Intelligence Estimate with journalists in the summer of 2003 as part of an effort to rebut charges that were then being made by former U.S. Ambassador Joseph Wilson, writes Murray Watts in the National Journal, that the Bush administration had misrepresented intelligence information to make a public case for war. You recall Joe Wilson sent to Niger to check it out, and came back and said, there's no there. And the Bush administration, oh, yes, there is. And no, apparently there wasn't. So we'll see how this thing plays out as the story continues, as they say. In fact, I'm going to hand this back to you, David, and you can mark it up and see, you know, see what you can find in there. This is fascinating. Sometimes, you know, this show just goes off in completely different directions than I expected. Victoria Jones hands me some poor chaplain, or David hands me a breaking news. The Abramoff emails, this is, had this happened in the Clinton administration, every person in America would know the intimate details of it. And yet, I'll bet you that three-quarters of the people who vote don't realize the truth that Howard Dean kept laying out, that there's not one single dollar that came from Jack Abramoff to any Democrats, that this is entirely a Republican scandal. In any case, it's unfolding in big form now. And it's unfolding right in front of the White House. And this, Bush, I'm sure, just thinks he can get away with it the same way he did with Ken Lay. You'll recall when Enron and Ken Lay blew up back in 2002, as I recall, Bush said, well, you know, he supported Ann Richards, my opponent, in the gubernatorial race. Well, yeah, he sent a small check to Ann Richards, but he was the largest lifetime patron of the political career of George W. Bush, period. There was, you know, hundreds of letters between George and Kenny Boy. Ken Lay had his own desk in the White House. The folks at Enron were talking about him becoming Secretary of Energy as they were conspiring, apparently, with Arnold Schwarzenegger, secret meetings between Schwarzenegger and Ken Lay just before Enron brought down California, you know, shut down the power grid. You can see this whole thing in this marvelous movie that's out now. The Enron, the brightest guy, the smartest guys in the room, or the brightest guys in the room, whatever the subtitle is. So the Progress Report, the Center for American Progress, publishes this thing called the Progress Report. The Progress Report has obtained the text of emails written by Jack Abramoff in which the fallen lobbyist personally describes his relationship with President Bush. So here we've got Scooter Libby on the one hand, who is the assistant to the president and the chief of staff for the vice president, saying that when he committed treason, he did so because Dick Cheney instructed him to, and other superiors. Now, excuse me, if your bosses are Cheney and Bush, what other superiors are there besides Cheney? In any case, we got Scooter Libby now apparently saying, you know, I did it because he told me to. And now we also have Jack Abramoff rolling over on George W. Bush. These emails written by Jack Abramoff in which the fallen lobbyist personally describes his relationship with George Bush, they depict a relationship far more extensive than has been previously reported. The emails written by Abramoff were addressed to Kim Eisler, the national editor of Washingtonian Magazine. The Washingtonian recently reported the existence of several photographs showing Abramoff and Bush together. Eisler is also the author of Revenge of the Pequots, a book about tribal politics for which Abramoff was interviewed. White House Secretary Scott McClellan has claimed any contacts between Abramoff and Bush were limited to a few widely attended holiday receptions at the White House. Bush has said flatly of Abramoff, "I don't know him." According to Eisler, however, Abramoff wrote, quote, this is quoting Jack Abramoff's email, Bush saw me in almost a dozen settings and joked with me about a bunch of things, including details of my kids. End of quote. According to Eisler, Jack Abramoff has several photos with President Bush and First Lady Laura Bush in his house, just sitting in his office. McClellan has previously said if photos of Bush with Abramoff exist, they were shots taken at widely attended Hanukkah receptions in 2001 and 2002. That's not what Eisler saw in Abramoff's home office. He reports that none of the photographs at Abramoff's home office were from holiday parties. One photo at Abramoff's office depicts Bush shaking hands with Abramoff inside the old executive office building. That's the vice president's office. Another shows Bush with Abramoff at what appears to be the Corcoran Gallery of Art. A third photo, which has not previously been disclosed, is of Abramoff's wife with Laura Bush. As the details about Abramoff's relationship with Bush emerge, at the same time as a criminal investigation, which has already rocked Congress, it's zeroing in on the administration, notes the Progress Report. The Wall Street Journal noted yesterday that the scandal court poses significant problems for the Bush White House. Yes. Can you spell Teapot Dome? The Teapot Dome scandal was, you know, which nearly brought down Warren Harding's administration. It certainly stained it for all of history. Albert fell, or it was a fall, I forget which. Anyhow, he was the Secretary of the Interior, responsible for, you know, the federal land and the oil underneath it. And he leased in Wyoming this little bit of land, the Teapot Dome area, to a buddy of his, an oil company buddy of his, who gave him, as I recall, $100,000, maybe it was $200,000. It wasn't much. It was certainly less than $500,000. And that scandal nearly brought down Warren Harding's administration. And this is, you know, another Republican. David Safavian, another Bush administration official, has already been indicted for giving Mr. Abramoff inside information from the GSA at the time when he was seeking government leases for a client for Tyco. He's also accused of misleading investigators about a golfing trip to Scotland. It gets better and better, folks. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And the people in the houses all go to the university, and they all get put in boxes, little boxes, all the same. And there's doctors, and there's lawyers, and business executives, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all just the same.
And they all voted for George Bush, and now they're all discovering that the guy is turning this country into an armed camp, into a prison camp. I mean, it's just incredible. Hillary Clinton stands up and says Republicans are playing the fear card. This I mentioned this at the beginning of the program. It's worth mentioning again. Hillary Clinton, New York Democrat, she's running for re-election this year. Widely regarded by the insiders in Washington D.C. as the front runner for the Democratic candidacy in 2008. Reports are Karl Rove has already begun developing a strategy to destroy Hillary Clinton. And what can I say? But in any case, Hillary Clinton came out and she said that when Rove 2 weeks ago laid out, you know, basically the GOP election strategy, she says what he said was, all we've got is fear and we're going to keep playing the fear card. And she went on to say, I take a backseat to nobody when it comes to fighting terrorism and standing up for national homeland security. And referring to Osama bin Laden, she says, you cannot explain to me why we have not captured or killed the tallest man in Afghanistan. So here she is. And she goes on. She says, since when has it been part of American patriotism to keep our mouths shut? Well, since Bush took over. Hillary Clinton stands up and says, we have nothing to fear but fear itself, essentially. We're not going to be cowed. We're not going to be made to behave like we're terrified. And then what happens? All the senators get herded into the Capitol basement, into the parking garage, into terrified, huddled masses, because there's a nerve gas alert in the Capitol. There's poison gas at loose, at large. Be afraid. Be very afraid. This is just so ironic. I'm telling you, this, if you have to understand how Machiavellian politics really can be in the United States. And not just in America. I mean, just right across the board. And I guarantee you, the irony of this, Hillary Clinton standing up and saying, we will not be terrified by you. The only thing you've got to use is fear, and we're not buying it. And then all of a sudden she finds herself along with a bunch of other senators. And I'm not sure if she was among them. Maybe she was out of the building. But all of a sudden all the senators find themselves in a huddled mass down in the basement of the Capitol looking out for this cloud of poison gas that's supposed to be coming to get them. I guarantee you the irony of that was not lost on her or on other politicians. And I guarantee you that there are some politicians who are sitting around going, where did this poison gas alert originate? Is this what happens when Hillary speaks out? Is this what happens when any Democrat speaks out? It's certainly what happened when John Kerry spoke out during the 2004 election over and over and over again. Anytime John Kerry was getting any traction at all in that election, Tom Ridge would come out and say, oh, we've got to raise the terror alert. What, do we have over 20 terror alerts during the election campaign? My recollection, it was close to 30, 28, 27, something like that. And you look back, and it was every single time John Kerry started getting some traction in the press or George W. Bush started looking bad in the press, terror alert! And then Tom Ridge, after this is all over, after the election, after he's retired, put out to pasture, making a nice living in the private sector. Tom Ridge, I saw him on at least two television programs. My recollection was that it was Letterman and Jon Stewart's Daily Show. I'm not sure of the Letterman one. I am sure of the Daily Show. Tom Ridge comes out and says, well, you know, I didn't order all those terror alerts. The White House told me to do it. The White House told me to do it. So here we've got clear evidence, and why the Democrats aren't just using this to pound the Republicans about the head and shoulders, I can't tell you. I'm sorry. The only thing I can say is that you've got some advisors over there in the Democratic Party who either are, you know, the most incompetent and useless political advisors in the history of the planet, or they are stealth Republicans. But why the Democrats are not beating up the Republicans with this, you used terror, Mr. Bush or Mr. Rove, against the American people during the election of 2004. And now it looks like he's using it against the United States Senate, or maybe not. Maybe it's just a coincidence. Maybe there's no conspiracy here at all. You know, just nothing here to look at. Just, you know, keep moving along. Nothing here. Pay no attention.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
Yeah. No attention at all. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. The place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, I don't think so. Yeah.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Will you come down from your ivory tower? You will see how it really must be. When you come down, down, down from your ivory tower.
Yes, indeed. Welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Barb in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, Barb, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I've been listening to you the last couple of days, and you've talked about Syria. And then I caught an article where Scott Ritter said that he thought that it's, you know, that we're going to go into Iran. And
yeah, he said that on this program a year ago, actually.
Okay. I guess, you know, that being said, you know, I don't know how we're exactly going to accomplish that with the military such as it is. But what I keep getting hung up on, and maybe you could clarify this for me, is maybe it's a fear factor that the Bush and his administration does, and it keeps saying that we're at war, we're at war, we're at war. But my understanding is we have not declared war against Iraq.
No, there is no formal declaration of war.
Yeah, but he gets away with everything under this premise that we're at war.
Right. There was a congressional authorization to use force.
Yes.
But that's different than a declaration of war. There also, however, I mean, just, you know, not to put too fine a point on this, Barb, but there was no declaration of war in Vietnam or in Korea. And yet we had troops in both involved in both situations. The draft was mobilized during Vietnam. Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon both, shall we say, went to extraordinary lengths. In fact, Nixon suggested that, you know, if the president does it, it's legal. He wiretapped people and things, and he tried to use the war as an excuse. So this isn't without precedent.
Okay. I just, you know, it really bothers me a lot. And he keeps saying we're at war, and, you know, and he needs to protect me. And he's the last person I need to be protecting me.
Yeah, and in fact, this administration is not protecting us. They are making the world a much more dangerous place.
Yeah.
And the clear and present threats to the United States, things like chemical plants, things like nuclear power plants that have cooling ponds where they're storing nuclear material that if it was hit with a small airplane, could render a 100-square-mile area unlivable for a 500,000 years. None of them have been protected at all. In fact, we discovered in the 9/11 report that Mohammed Atta had originally thought when he hijacked the airplanes that he would fly one of them into the Indian Point nuclear power plant just north of New York City, because if he hit that power plant or if he hit the cooling pool next to it where they've got, you know, years worth of radioactive waste stored, if he hit that thing with a jet, then the radiation plume would render the entire New York City area. I mean, we're not just talking Manhattan. We're talking, you know, 50 to 100 square mile or 100 mile radius around the plant. Uninhabitable, essentially forever, you know, for all of human history.
Right.
And he decided not to do that because he concluded that the United States would not be so stupid as to leave it unprotected, that there must be, like, you know, surface-to-air missiles there that would shoot the plane down. And so he decided not to take the chance. In fact, it was unprotected then, and this came out in the New York Times. This came out in the 9/11 Commission report. I'm not, like, here giving terrorists ideas. This was talked about by, you know, Governor Keene, the chairman of the 9/11 Commission,
yeah.
And it's still to this day unprotected, as are all the other nuclear power plants in this country. Bush, they want to wand down Granny and check our shoes, but the cargo in the belly of the airplanes is not being inspected right now. It's all a circus. It's all a show.
Yeah, it's really smoke and mirrors, and it's just ridiculous. And so my question on Iran and Syria then is, would he have to get another authorization for force? Because I can't see where the UN is going to support us in anything.
No, I don't think the UN is, and I frankly don't know. Legally, I mean, you'd have to ask a lawyer. I can tell you, practically speaking, that Bush keeps referring back to the original authorization, which was in the weeks after 9/11. I think it
for
was
Afghanistan.
2 weeks. Well, this was not even for Afghanistan, although it was used for Afghanistan. It was a broad blanket authorization that basically said, you know, the Congress supports the president in his efforts to track down and punish or bring to justice the perpetrators of 9/11. And he keeps pointing back to that. And so my guess is that if he doesn't want to go back to Congress, and he won't, that he'll simply figure out they're gonna suddenly discover that the weapons of mass destruction, or that the plotters of 9/11, or that there's some connection to 9/11 in Iran that they're going to have to go after. Although, as I've said many times, I think it's going to be Syria first, because I think that they could take out Syria in a weekend, and I think taking out Iran is going to be a very, very big job.
But the practicality for that is, who are we going to go and take them out with? I mean, you know, what troops?
Well, we still have actually a substantial military force. It's just that we'd have to pull a lot of our troops out of Germany. I think we've got 30,000-40,000 troops in Germany. I'm not sure how many we have in South Korea. I think it's another 30,000-40,000 there. I'm not a military expert in this stuff, but I know that we have a lot of troops, number one. And number two, this guy is so committed to, you know, man the torpedoes and damn the consequences, that it wouldn't surprise me if they're thinking in Washington, D.C., that they could do this entirely as an air war. If they could just go in and just, you know, bomb them back to the Stone Age, to paraphrase General Curtis LeMay from the Vietnam War, and accomplish it that way. And I put nothing past them.
Okay.
Barb, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you very much.
Not the most lighthearted topic, but one that I think we need to talk about occasionally. Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind today?
Tom, in Pennsylvania, we have a mandate from the federal government that we are required to give our Social Security number in order to get a hunting license.
Why?
Because what they said they want to do, they want to track down deadbeat dads. Now, the federal government doesn't track down deadbeat dads. And I called congressmen, or not congressmen, well, I did call one congressman, and I called our state senators and legislators. And what they said that the federal government is going to hold all this gasoline money back from the state if they don't go by this mandate.
Yeah.
And I said, well, if you're a criminal, if you're a deadbeat dad, I said, can't you plead the Fifth Amendment? I said, they have more rights than us. And I said, not only that, I said, what about the Miranda rights where you don't even have to talk about anything, you know, if it's going to incriminate you later on down the line. But so far, what I got, and this is even from the NRA, I called the NRA on it, and I want to know why this is. I said, it looks to me it's a confiscation of weapons. I says, so that everyone that signs for a hunting license, give her a Social Security, and the federal government has that.
Yeah.
They want to confiscate your weapons.
These guys, you know, Jim, I'm not disagreeing with you at all. I think that your concern is well-founded. And in fact, what we're looking at now is a federal government, and this is, by the way, the federal government that the Barry Goldwater conservatives back in the old days were afraid would happen, only they thought that it was going to be liberals who would do it, right,
right.
In quotes.
Right.
A federal government that is gathering mind-boggling amounts of information on you and me, and sharing that information, by the way, with private corporations to the benefit and profit of those private corporations. I mean, you can't, Jim, you can't get a mortgage on your home without giving your Social Security number.
Well,
and tell me why they need that.
That's what I'm saying. Now, if I want to go for a building permit next year, you know, for my home, I probably have to do the same thing.
Oh, if you want to get a credit card at the local department store.
I know.
If,
well,
you know,
I did away with that. I don't even.
No, but my point is that you know, when I was a kid and you know, I remember going down and getting a Social Security card when I was, I don't know, 12, 13 years old, something like that. And, you know, back then you had to go in and apply for it and everything. And we were told that that number could never, by law, that number could not be required for identification by anybody except the Social Security
right.
Administration. And
right.
We all said, good. And we saluted that flag, you know, and said, yes. And now it's like, you know, you go to the dentist and they want to know your Social Security number.
Yeah, it's really mind-blowing. And I wish I could hear the ACLU come out on that somehow. You know,
yeah.
I would like to see them. I mean, I'm just an individual, you know, to work for a living, and I don't have the money to go into that. But the ACLU should step forward on something like this. My God. You know, look what they just did down in Louisiana again. They evicted the refugees from the
yeah,
hurricane.
5,000 of them last week, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, is Iraq going to have a better constitution than us?
Well, it looks like that may be, Jim. I, you know, tragically.
Yeah, we're getting our kids killed over there to give them something that they're taking away from us here.
Yeah,
this administration, I'm telling you, nothing shocks me anymore what they're doing.
Yeah, and I got to tell you, here's, Jim, this from the Christian Science Monitor today. Check out the Christian Science Monitor, an article, the headline, U.S. plans massive data sweep. A little-known data collection system control news, blogs, even emails. Will it go too far? Question mark. By Mark Clayton. The U.S. government is developing a massive computer system that can collect huge amounts of data, and by linking far-flung information from blogs and email to government records and intelligence reports, search for patterns of what they call terrorist activity. The question is, when are they going to decide who's a terrorist?
Right? Well, they did want to put the... yeah, you got it right there. They did want to put chips in the babies a while back, didn't they?
Yeah, and they say in this article, the system, parts of which are operational, parts of which are still under development, is already credited with helping to foil some plots. This is the rationale they always trot out. You know, we are keeping you safe. That's why we need to do away with your liberty. I mean, what happened to Patrick Henry? Give me liberty or give me death. These guys are like, give me a little bit of security and that's enough.
Tom, you mentioned before that they put the scare tactics on us.
Yeah.
Do you know who did that?
No,
Joe Goebbels.
Oh, Joe Goebbels. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And in fact, at his trial in Nuremberg, gave that little speech about all you have to do is terrify people and then tell them you'll protect them and they'll go along with anything. Good point. Thanks a lot for the call. I got to move along. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann Radio Program, where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all.
Yeah, that's their strategy, my friends.
A working class hero is something to be.
There you go. Now, the Dean scream played over and over and over again. Why was it that the Gonzalez moment was only shown on a few television programs like Olbermann's Countdown Show and wasn't repeated over and over and over again? David Cole, a Georgetown University law professor, writes of his experience. He was there. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez spoke before law students here at Georgetown University earlier this week, justifying illegal, unauthorized surveillance of U.S. citizens. But during the course of his speech, the students in class did something quite unexpected in this time of sheepishness and timidity. They got up from their seats and turned their backs to him. To make matters worse for Gonzalez, additional students came into the room wearing black cowls and carrying a simple banner written on a sheet that said, quote, "Those who would trade liberty for security deserve neither," end quote, dash Ben Franklin. Fortunately for Gonzalez, it was a brief speech followed by a panel discussion that basically ripped his argument in half. And as one of the people on the panel said, quote, "When you're a law student, they tell you that if you can't argue the law, argue the facts. They also tell you if you can't argue the facts, argue the law. If you can't argue either, apparently, the solution is to go on a public relations offensive and to make it a political issue, to say over and over and over again, it's lawful, and to think that the American people will somehow come to believe this if we say it often enough," end quote. David Cole, Georgetown University professor of law, says, "In light of this, I'm proud of the very civil disobedience that was shown here today at Georgetown University." And then you get Alberto Gonzalez going before the camera, going before the Senate, and they're asking him questions, and he says,
"Well, I don't know, Senator. I'm just not going to answer. The president hasn't authorized me to talk about that."
And you just want to reach across the TV and go, "Wake up, Alberto! Come on, tell us some truth."
"Well, I'm sorry. The president has to. Senator, that's just a hypothetical."
Dan in Seattle. Hey, Dan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom.
Pardon my lousy Alberto Gonzalez imitation.
Are you there?
I'm here. Are you there? Dan, if you can hear.
I don't know if you can hear me or not. I've got the quote from Tom Ridge for some reason. He didn't seem to make my skin crawl as much as the rest of the Bush gang.
Yeah.
His quote was, "More often than not, we were the least inclined to raise it," Ridge told reporters. "Sometimes we disagreed with the intelligence assessment. Sometimes we thought even if the intelligence was good, you don't necessarily put the country on alert. There were times when some people were really aggressive about raising it, and we said, for what?" You know, for some reason, Mr. Ridge seems to want to redeem himself.
Right, yeah, and he's out there telling the truth, which is a startling thing, and it just got no play at all in the media.
Yeah,
no play at all, Dan.
This story is my pet peeve of all the non-reported stories out there. This is the number one pet peeve I've had.
Yeah, the George
comes out and said they were scaring you during the election. I was part of that, and coming out means he really, you know, didn't like doing it.
Right. He was confessing. It was amazing. Dan, thanks for the call, and thanks for digging that out and sharing it with us. I recall the exact language now, and it did make the news, but for one day. Charlie in Pittsburgh. Hey, Charlie.
Hi, Tom. As I told your screener, I'm a conservative. I listen to your show on occasion.
Well, good on you. What does it mean to be a conservative to you, Charlie?
Oh, that's pretty complicated. I was calling in reference to the lady who called at the top of the hour asking, from a liberal point of view, what you can do. And I'll give you some, I didn't call to argue with you about anything, but my point was, I think the problem, because there's a lot of conservatives may share some concerns with, let's say, Democrats or liberal Democrats. I don't want to use any labels, but for lack of a better term.
Sure, I understand.
We feel we're mischaracterized and underestimated by the left and by Democrats in particular. And I think that's why your message doesn't get across to maybe a lot of people who share a lot of the values that you do. And I think that's where your message gets lost. My situation, I guess I'm the ultimate enemy. I'm a white male conservative Christian.
So am I.
And we feel that.
So am I, Charlie. Does that make either one of us the enemy of the other?
Well, where your message is getting lost is in a lot of the vitriol that's out there and the way I think that people like me are characterized by some spokespeople.
But see, I suspect, Charlie, and just think about this seriously for a minute. I don't characterize you in the cartoon fashion that you're objecting to. My experience of listening to conservative talk radio for the last 15 years has been that conservative talk radio has been telling people like you and me that, quote, liberals are characterizing us in these particular ways, when in fact, I don't know of any, quote, liberals who are talking like that. This is called a straw man argument.
Well, let me give you an example of where I'm coming from.
We only have a minute left, by the way, Charlie. I'm sorry.
The abortion issue, for one, believe me, I'm not anti-woman. I'm not trying to turn back the clock. But I don't think you understand the depth of feeling among conservative Christians about that issue.
No, I do. I know it's very strong among a lot of people. I got that.
And, for instance, the environment, we're not for dirty water. We're not for poisoning people. There's a lot of characterizations like that.
I know you're not. But what I'm saying is that the politicians who are representing you, who claim to be representing you, are. And that's the problem that both you and I have.
Agreed.
Is that when you've
but
got
where the problem
Charlie, I'm sorry, we're out of time. Call back later on. We'll continue this conversation. It's a good one, and I appreciate your civil tone. We'll continue with it. Coming up on the next Tom Hartman program, Bernie Sanders is going to be here. John Sweeney, president of the FL-CIO and the State of the Union for Workers tomorrow. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.